理课堂听 class.com。
We talked for several hours about his plans. Although I could see some problems with his ideas, I liked them nonetheless, and started to feel his excitement. We then went back to his hiding place in the basement of a house on Putney Hill. He showed me the hole that he had been digging for the past week or so. I must admit that I was a bit disappointed. I felt that I could have done as much work in one day. Regardless, I helped him to dig further, for he believed that underneath were the tunnels he had earlier spoken about. I helped him dig for about an hour, thinking more and more about the problems with his plans. Then he stopped and suggested that we go out and have a look around for Martians. I did not understand why this was necessary and suggested that we keep digging, but then I thought about how I had run into him out among the fields. "Why weren't you here digging earlier?" I asked.
"Oh, I just thought I'd have a nice walk," he said.
"But aren't you in a hurry to get through to the underground? Why stop working?" He only answered by suggesting that we go have another look about town for Martians. I then understood that this man was not quite as strong-willed as he had led me to believe. We went outside and walked about the village. We saw nothing but patches of that red Martian plant life here and there, covering sections of the fields and climbing up the sides of trees, mingling with the leaves. While walking about, he told me a story about some survivors who had not left London like the rest of the people. This small group of people had somehow managed to get the electricity back on in a certain part of the city. Seeing their success, they all went out into the street and partied well into the evening, drinking and singing and dancing. Suddenly, one of the Martian fighting machines appeared and picked up about 200 of those people and disappeared down the street. We then returned to the house, and my companion became more cheerful. He was happy to have me around, it seemed. Together we made a rather big meal, and afterwards smoked cigars of the highest quality. Then we spent much of the rest of the day drinking champagne and playing card games. Eventually, the artilleryman fell asleep from all of his drinking. I had only 2 glasses, for I did not like champagne very much, nor was I especially in the mood for celebration. I decided to go outside again and have a look at those lights he had mentioned to me earlier in the day. As I looked off into the distant red glow of the still-burning area of Kensington, I began to feel ashamed of myself. Here I was eating large meals, smoking cigars, and drinking champagne while the rest of humanity was suffering just a few miles away. I immediately decided to leave this man to his useless dreams and go on to London to see what the people who really wanted to save the human race were doing. Chapter 24. Walking Through the Remains of London. As I moved further and further into London, I found the streets covered in black dust. The only people I saw were those lying dead in the street, their bodies horribly burned. I did come across one living man, but he was so drunk that he could not stand. His clothing was completely covered in dust, and when I tried to talk with him, he did nothing but shout at me and try to hit me with his bottle. I walked on, thinking how strange the silence was. It was not a peaceful silence, but a dangerous one in which one expects something horrible to happen. When I reached South Kensington, the silence was suddenly broken by the sound of a fighting machine that was coming. I stayed in the shadows along Exhibition Street and made my way toward Hyde Park. Along the way, I came upon a bus that had been pushed over onto its side. Nearby, there were the remains of a horse that had been completely eaten down to the bone by some kind of animal. Again, the cry of the fighting machine filled the air.
Oola, oola, oola.
I could not see it, but it seemed to be coming closer, or I was coming closer to it. I turned off again, now headed for Oxford Street. As I walked, the faces of old friends came into my mind, and once again, I realized how lonely I was. I missed my old way of life terribly. Eventually, I broke into a restaurant where I found some food and drink. Afterward, I felt sleepy, and so I went to a back room and lay down on the sofa to have a rest. When I later awoke, the sun was setting, and I could still hear the crying of the Martian machine. Not feeling particularly safe in the pub, I walked back out into the streets and continued my tour of the now dead city of London. After only a few minutes, I found myself near Baker Street. Just over the tops of some trees, there appeared the head of the Martian machine that had been crying out all this time. Strangely enough, I did not feel afraid. I walked out into the open, staring curiously at the giant machine, and it did nothing but remain motionless. I decided that I should get a better look at the machine, so I turned down some back streets and made my way toward it from the east. When it came into sight again, I could see that it had been seriously damaged. It looked as though it had run into a building and fallen underneath the ruins. With the last of the day's sunlight, I could just barely see what I thought might be blood in the driver's seat. I moved on and found another Martian fighting machine at Primrose Hill. It too cried out, "Oola, oola, oola," and did not move. As I passed by, I noticed on the other side of the Martian that the red plant life had spread through London's river canals. Then the crying of the machine suddenly stopped, and a shocking silence fell over the city. The stillness made me frightened again. I felt that I was surrounded by enemies waiting in the darkness for the right moment to attack. Everything looked evil. Even the houses with their ghost-like windows seemed to be watching me. I began to run toward Kilburn and spotted a horrible-looking body lying far down the road before me. I turned and went in another direction for fear of what I might find. For the rest of the night, I closed myself inside a cabman's shelter and waited for my courage to return. Then, just before sunrise, I decided to go back out into the streets to have a look. I found my way back to Primrose Hill, and the first thing that I saw was yet another Martian fighting machine. Just like the others, it now stood silent, as though sleeping. Upon walking closer, I saw dozens of birds flying in circles about its domed head. My heart suddenly leaped with excitement, and I began to run toward the giant. An idea had formed in my mind, but I did not want to use it before I actually knew the truth. I finally made it to the top of the hill that overlooked the last pit the Martians had made. It was huge and filled with all kinds of war machines and bodies. This time, however, the bodies were not human. No, there before me lay the bodies of at least 50 Martians. I wanted to shout with joy at the sight. The Martians, despite their incredible intelligence and their highly advanced technology, had lost the battle in the end. The battle had not, however, been won by the humans, whose weapons proved useless in the fight. It had been won by the earth, by nature. The Martians, who were not exposed to any bacteria on Mars, were practically swimming in it here on our planet. Although bacteria often bring sickness and death to men, this time it had saved us all from the Martians. Looking down into the pit, I could now see the flying machine that the Martians had been building just before they fell to their deaths. Dozens of dogs were running about the pit, eating the Martian bodies. It was strange indeed to look at the once horrifying fighting machines and now feel no fear whatsoever. I wanted to laugh at their harmlessness. From where I stood, I could see most of London spread out before me. How amazing it was that it still stood here after so much death and destruction. And even though terribly damaged, how lovely and alive it looked to me now. Soon, people would be returning to London and their homes. They would begin their lives again. I could already hear the sound of hammers at work in my mind, and what beautiful music it made. And then the thought of my own home and my family came back to me. Hope came upon me stronger than ever before. Maybe I could have my old life back again. Chapter 25. My Return Home. I am not sure why, but I cannot remember what happened over the next 3 days. I must have been completely overcome with relief and joy. Over time, I learned that I was not quite the first person to realize the end of the Martians had come. It turns out that while I was hiding in the cabman's shelter, another gentleman had come across the dead Martians and immediately set out to inform the world by telegraph. I had no idea that at the very same moment I was looking down upon the ruins of the Martian pit, most of the world was celebrating the liberation of England. Of course, the last people to know were the English themselves, for most of them were still in hiding. However, once the news reached them, they came running back to their beloved London. Countries from all over the world began to send food to the English, and it seemed that every ship in the ocean was headed toward our fair country. As for me, an extremely kind family found me wandering the streets, half mad, singing songs about being the last man alive in the world. They took me into their home and took care of me, patiently waiting and hoping I would soon regain my senses. I, of course, did calm down after about 4 days. They gave me another day's rest before breaking the news to me that all of Leatherhead had been destroyed. Not a single person survived the attack. I stayed with them for 4 more days, feeling hopelessly sad and lonely. They did their best to help me, which I find amazing, considering that they had their own problems to deal with. The desire to revisit my hometown was so strong in me that I told the family that I would have to leave right away. They tried to change my mind, but I could not be reasoned with. I set out on the 9th day and found the streets of London once again alive with thousands of people. I was very surprised to see that some stores had already reopened and that water was flowing from some of the fountains in the squares. The sun that day was so bright that I felt it was making a joke of my sad situation. Most of the people I saw on the street seemed to be either unbelievably happy or quietly accepting of their circumstances. Most of the people looked tired and unhealthy. Their clothing was still dirty and their hair a filthy mess. While crossing Waterloo Bridge, I caught sight of a man selling newspapers. It was the first newspaper to go back into print. The news indicated that much had already been learned from the scientists' examination of the Martian equipment. The scientists even thought that they had discovered the secret of flying. Much to my relief, I had an entire compartment on the train all to myself. It seemed that over the 9 days of my recovery, most of the people had managed to return to their homes. I had no desire to converse with anyone and spent the entire train ride silently staring out the window at the changed countryside. Most of the towns I passed were in smoking ruins. Only one town seemed untouched, but that was only because its thick forest of pine trees hid the destruction from the train passengers. When I arrived at Byfleet Station, I exited the train and walked toward my town of Maybury. I came upon the overturned wagon I had rented from the pub owner, and next to it were the bones of his horse. I stood there in quiet thought for quite some time before moving on. A man standing outside of the neighborhood pub greeted me by name as I approached. I returned the greeting and asked about the pub owner. He told me that he had been buried a few days before. I thanked him for the information and started the last few meters to my home. At first, I thought that there was hope for my wife to be there, but that thought quickly disappeared When I saw that the house was in the same condition I had left it in that night of the storm. The lock on the front door was broken, and when I entered the front hallway, I saw stains on the floor from when I had returned to the house, soaking wet and hidden from the Martians. The tracks of both mine and the artilleryman's footsteps still led up the stairs and into my study, and there on the table lay the paper on which I had started my latest philosophical article. I went back downstairs and saw the remains of the meal the artilleryman and I had had before running out of town. The house was so silent and lonely. I felt a terrible sadness building up inside of me. Then I heard a voice from behind me say, "Let's go. It was unwise to come here. It's obvious that no one has survived." For a moment, I thought that I might have said the words to myself, but then I ran to the window and found myself looking into the eyes of my cousin and my wife. We stayed that way, silent and staring in disbelief for several moments before I saw my wife's eyes start to turn upward, and I ran to catch her before she completely fainted. Epilogue. As I look back on the pages I have here written, it has become clear to me that not everyone will completely agree with my story. There are many questions about why and how the Martians died so quickly. I, however, am not an expert in the area of biological science, so I am happy with the popular reports. It has not yet been made clear what exactly the Martians' black gas consisted of. Scientists found an unknown substance among the contents, but they have yet to understand it completely, nor are its effects on the human body very clear. Of course, because so few people actually saw the Martians themselves, people have taken great interest in the Martian body that has been preserved and put on display at the Museum of Natural History in London. Very few of these were remaining due to the number of wild dogs that had seized upon them just after death. This one is almost in perfect condition. Surprisingly, one subject which is not very often discussed is the possibility of another Martian attack. Personally, I am quite concerned, for it seems very likely to happen someday. I feel that we should be keeping a close eye on Mars, especially the area where the gun was seen shooting the cylinders to our planet. Earth should always be ready for a second attack. In fact, I think that the Martians' failure has given humans a hint as to how to defend themselves should history repeat itself. For example, we now know that the Martians are powerless when they first land, for they have to wait for their cylinder to cool or they will burn themselves. We could simply destroy the cylinder during this early period. If no bombs are available at the time, guns could be set upon the Martians as they first come out of their cylinder. In other words, I do not think that the Martians will have as easy a time if they attacked us in the same manner. But then again, they may be aware of this themselves and could already have started planning a new method of attack. In any case, the attack on Earth has benefited man in some ways. First of all, it has made us more aware of the idea that perhaps we are not the highest form of life in the universe. This is a good thing because man had become quite arrogant and abused his powers over less powerful creatures, like animals and plants. Maybe now man will be kinder to the animals on this planet. The second benefit is the technology that has been passed on to us. I believe that over the next 100 years, man may make incredible scientific leaps forward. Who knows? Maybe one day we will be visiting other planets ourselves. I have to say that I am not as comfortable with my life on Earth as I was before the war. Every day I look out the window of my study, and I see the slowly recovering landscape once again on fire. I see the milkman pass my home, and the children running to school, and I remember all of those frightened faces as people ran from Woking that terrible Saturday. I visit London, and I see all of the business in the streets, the fruit sellers and the pub owners, And I remember all of those horribly burned bodies that filled the streets. I pass the still motionless metal fighting machine that today stands in the center of town as a reminder of the war, and a terrible cold feeling runs through my body as I recall that stormy night when that first giant fighting machine walked over me as I lay helpless in the mud. I am always thinking about these events. But the thing that affects me the most and always brings me to tears is when I look at my wife and think that she and I once thought the other was dead. I hope that the people of the future will never experience such terrible things. However, I am afraid that future people of the earth will experience more war and death. Not because of more Martian attacks, but because men will continue to fight with each other. It is my hope that of all the things that we learned from the Martians is we learned the need for peace on Earth, for that is the best way for the human race to survive.